Well, at the last General Conference of Elders, there was a keynote address given on a sense of urgency. It was by Richard Thompson, and I'm going to just hit the highlights of it. So his examples from the history of ancient Israel prove that people will do almost anything to survive physically. But he asked all to realize deeply our responsibility before God to survive spiritually in order to serve him and those he calls. So it's amazing what people will do to survive physically. But the challenge ahead of us in the future is to survive spiritually. How urgent is God about his work? How urgent is Jesus Christ? How urgent were Paul, John, Peter, and many others in that long list of our spiritual examples? And how urgent are we? Is that urgency mainly tied to the idea that Christ will return very soon? If it is, the New Testament record must guide us to a deeper understanding. There came a time when those early pioneers of the faith realized that Christ was not going to return in their lifetimes. While he may well yet come back in ours, no one knows the day or the hour. What drove those servants on was a sense of urgency. Let me start over on that one. What drove those servants on when the sense of urgency was not due to expecting Christ's return momentarily? What compelled them then? Being urgent is as much about eternal character as it is about time. The actual timing of Christ's return, in one sense, has nothing to do with the urgency of our efforts to do God's work. Near the end of his life, Paul told Timothy to continue in the job of the ministry, no matter what time might do. The urgency in our lives and ministry must be present, no matter what the timing of Christ's return may be. The gospel needs to be preached, and its people need to be prepared. We have the prophecies of God's word to warn us about what is happening in our world and its declining morals. The bride of Christ must be prepared. And it goes on a little bit from there. But we do need a sense of urgency. It's easy to think that, well, you know, time may go on, and even if time does go on, there needs to be that urgency. About a year ago, I gave a sermonette, and I'm going to go through it again briefly as an introduction to what I'm going to talk about today. But the sermonette was about the redefinition of two terms, love and hate. And I started out by going over some scriptures that explain that Satan the devil is the god of this world. You don't need to turn to any of these because it's a recap. But in 2 Corinthians 4, verse 3 and 4, it says, "But if our gospel be hid, it is hid to them that are lost, in whom the god of this world has blinded the minds of them which believe not." So it plainly says that the god of this world has blinded people, and that god is Satan. Just as the millennium is a reflection of God's mind and God's way, so is this world that we see developing around us a reflection of Satan's way and Satan's mind. In 2 Corinthians 11:14, earlier Paul was talking about false apostles and false ministers, and he said, "No marvel, for Satan himself is transformed into an angel of light. Therefore it is no great thing if his ministers also be transformed as the ministers of righteousness." And in Revelation 12 and verse 9, it says, "That great dragon was cast out, that old serpent called the devil and Satan, which deceives the whole world." And this deception will be so great that it says in Matthew 24 and verse 24 that such signs and wonders would be shown that even the very elect would be in danger of being deceived. So even those that are led by God's Holy Spirit will need to be on their guard to watch for this deception. There's a command in the Bible that some people call the forgotten command. It's in Matthew 24:4. And it's repeated over and over again, and I've actually spoken on it before. But the command is to take heed that no one deceives you. To stay alert. Because there's a battle raging on, and it's a battle for our mind. It's a battle to control our thoughts and our minds. In Ephesians 6:11, it's a familiar scripture, it says that we don't wrestle against flesh and blood. Our battle isn't a physical battle, but we wrestle against spiritual wickedness in high places. It's a spiritual battle. And in this battle, as in any battle, it's wise to gather information about your enemy. It's wise to know your enemy so that you can combat what the enemy throws at you. So what is Satan up to? Besides his proven techniques of deceiving and destroying individuals, what is he doing to set the stage for the end time? And I gave these three things. There's a cultural shift underway from a Christian paradigm to a global paradigm. A cultural shift from a Christian to a global paradigm. The second thing is a shift from truth, fact, and logic. You know, when I grew up in the educational system, there was a right and there was a wrong. There were facts and logic dictated answers. Today it's tending to go towards myth, feeling, and imagination. They're using these tools to teach. We'll get into more of that later. Three is the acceptance of an earth-centered spirituality. The acceptance of an earth-centered spirituality, and with it a code of ethics that rules out biblical truth. We've heard a lot about this. Basically, God the Father is being replaced by Mother Earth. Goddess worship is in. God the Father is out. There are volumes of information about this. I talked about one aspect about a year ago, and that was the redefinition of two words, love and hate. Love is being redefined to mean tolerance and acceptance. Tolerance and acceptance. And hate is being redefined to mean intolerance and non-acceptance. We're going to hear a lot about this kind of love, the kind of love that has been being redefined. Tolerance and acceptance. This kind of love makes a lot of sense to a lot of people, especially if you're a humanist or a globalist. This will be the glue that will hold this end time system together. Now, this kind of love is very ecumenical in nature. This kind of love, you know, doesn't God love everyone? What's wrong with ordaining a gay pastor? What could possibly be wrong with that if you're tolerant and loving? You know, what's wrong with performing lesbian marriages? You know, if you're tolerant and acceptant. Now, on the flip side of this, you know, God's true people will be viewed as intolerant and closed-minded. I watched a show quite some time ago. It was on one of the A&E shows or something like that, biography. But it was on Jezebel. And they were talking about Jezebel, who was the wife of King Ahab. And basically, the story as it was presented was that Ahab married this foreign princess or whatever she was, and she came back to Israel, and she was simply sharing her belief system with the rest of Israel, and these closed-minded Israelites killed her for it. And they were interviewing all these experts from different seminaries and so forth, and they were all giving their expert opinion on how this was just such a terrible thing. Because the only thing that this kind of love can't tolerate is intolerance. I was on the internet last night, and I ran across this article on WorldNet Daily. And the heading is, Testing the Faith. And this happened in Canada. Basically what happened was the subheading, Canadian Tribunal Rules Paper Can't Run Ad with Critical Scriptures. And what happened was they were having Gay Pride Week in Canada, and a man took out an advertisement in a newspaper and listed four scriptures and what they said, and then put a little, a little circle with a line through it, and he had like two guys holding hands, and he had this, and it was the biblical condemnation of homosexuality. And what happened was a couple of homosexual activists saw the ad, and they complained to the province's Human Rights Commission. And the bottom line is, he lost. They took this to court, he lost. So in the ruling, the judge conceded, there is no question that Mr. Owens believed that he was publicly expressing his honestly held religious belief as it related to his interpretation of the Bible and its discussion on homosexuality. Notice how it says, his honestly held religious belief as it related to his interpretation, you see. But it was just the scripture that's just up there. She then added that the Saskatchewan Human Rights Code issues a reasonable restriction on Mr. Owens' right to freedom of expression. And here's the reason. Since the ad exposed the complainants, so the ad exposed these people to hatred, ridicule, and their dignity was affronted on the basis of their sexual orientation. So that's the reason. It exposed them to hatred. Commenting on the case during the hearings, University of Western Ontario law professor Ian Hunter wrote, if Mr. Owens cannot express his opinions through a paid ad in the Star Phoenix paper, can he express them from a street corner soapbox? From the pulpit of a church? Should he get himself elected, could he express them in the House of Commons? Do we have the right, and that's the question, do we have the right to express anti-consensus views anywhere in Canada? Then the article goes on and talks about the same thing happening in New York. But see, when you get to the point where you say, this isn't right, and all of a sudden it's hatred, see, that's the direction it's going. In the not too distant past, President Clinton held a hate crimes conference. Clinton's hate crimes conference called for some sort of club or organization at the school. We want to nip this in the bud, right? Some kind of a club or organization at school, because if you think about it, your parents are still pretty well separated. Most houses of worship are still fairly segregated. You have to find a disciplined, organized way out of this so that we can reach every child in an affirmative way before something bad happens. But that isn't enough. Every person, young and old, must be held responsible for reporting violations. Our president outlined the plan at his 1997 hate crimes conference. This is quotes, the Justice Department will make its own hate crimes training curriculum available. A lot of hate crimes still go on unreported. If a crime is unreported, that gives people an excuse to ignore it. The real answer to our success in this endeavor is obviously that we all have to work together. And all of you can strike new energy into this entire endeavor around the country. At the same conference, Attorney General Janet Reno added, "The first line of defense is to prevent it. And then it is very important, when you see hate, to speak out against it immediately and strike it down. How can we in the federal government improve our coordination with local law enforcement, with state authorities, and with groups such as the churches and other other groups in the community?" One, to get it reported. Now, she wants to get it reported. And two, to work with you so that the investigations and the prosecutions are designed with one objective in mind, to eliminate hate. So she wants to get it reported and prosecuted. Probably half the people in here have heard the excerpt from 60 Minutes when they interviewed Janet Reno in 1994. But they asked her to define a cultist. And this was her answer. "A cultist is one who has a strong belief in the Bible and the second coming of Christ, who frequently attends Bible studies, who has a high level of financial giving to a Christian cause, who homeschools for their children, who has accumulated survival foods and has a strong belief in the Second Amendment, and who distrusts the government." Now, here's the second sentence. "Any of these may qualify a person as a cultist. But certainly, more than one of these would cause us to look at this person as a threat, and his family as being in a risk situation that qualified for government interference." And then it says, "Do you qualify? Are you, as defined by U.S. Attorney General Janet Reno, a threat?" Pretty interesting. There's a transformation taking place around us. I think we all feel it. I mean, you know something is fishy, but don't really know why sometimes. I have a couple of book reviews. This was out of the WorldNet Daily, Sunday, April 15th, 2001. It's an interview. Jeff Metcalf interviewed globalist expert and author Ted Flynn. And he has a book out called The Hope of the Wicked. It says, "The most recent Labor Day weekend meeting at the United Nations, with 168 world leaders all in one place, was the largest gathering of its kind in world history." You know, that was an amazing thing, to have 168 world leaders all in one place. It says, "Yet, very little in-depth news coverage accompanied this historic meeting, even though its ever-arching purpose was to help further a globalist agenda that many see as dangerous to America's and other nations' sovereignty." Ted Flynn has written The Hope of the Wicked, The Master Plan to Rule the World, which details many of the agendas of the globalist community. It explores the convergence on a global basis of multinational corporations, foundations, and the political and sociological instruments that would form a one-world government designed to bring about a new world order. With 550 pounds of text, 1,200 footnotes, Flynn's book provides a strong historical basis to show that there is an elite global elite working to end the sovereignty of nations and to place every person on earth under the authority of the United Nations. And then it goes on with the interview. First question, is there a conspiracy to rule the world? His answer, "In my opinion, it is not a conspiracy. When you diffuse this question, the rest just seems to fall into place. questions. Do you say it's not a conspiracy because it's out in the open for everyone to see? And the answer is yes and no. And then Jeff says, what are you, a politician? He says, sometimes my favorite color is plaid. But he goes on in this article to say that basically a lot of this is out in the open. And it really is. It's out, you know, you can find out easily. That, you know, we think of a conspiracy as, you know, a bunch of people in a dark room, you know, behind the scenes, you know, like five super powerful people that call all the shots. You know, and that really isn't the case. There are a lot of powerful people, and they all want basically the same thing. There are a lot of organizations, you know, there's the Gorbachev Foundation, there are, you know, all the names you hear about, you know, the Council on Foreign Affairs, the Trilateral Commission, and all these guys. But their goal is all basically the same. Later on, there's another question. When you talk about the intrusion of the United Nations agenda, a lot of people tend to say, hey, the United Nations, it doesn't affect me. I don't care. I was that way for decades. The United Nations, oh yeah, those guys are trying to do their thing, but hey, let them do their thing. It doesn't affect me. But however, they don't realize how insidious the tentacles are and how far-reaching they are. Right now, they're talking about a global tax, a global court, and they're trying to put together a global army. None of that stuff is coincidental. When you talk about the far-reaching tentacles, it was very interesting. I was trying to gather information on national parks. So we were going to go on vacation, and I was looking for information. And I typed into the search engine, you know, national parks, and an article popped up. They were trying, back east somewhere, to create a new national park. And part of it was, it cropped up as a sovereignty issue. And I thought, what has this got to do with our sovereignty? Well, as it turns out, most of our national parks are biosphere preserves. They're, I think that's UNESCO. It does the National Heritage or whatever it is. But anyway, they are international biosphere preserves. And as such, if the United States government wanted to do something at a national park that was beyond certain bounds, they would have to clear that with the United Nations to do that. And that's why it's a sovereignty issue. It puts some of the rules and regulations above that of our own law. That's an example of how far-reaching some of these things are. Another book that was reviewed, it was called One World. The subtitle, Best-Selling Author Exposes Deep Forces Behind Current Global Transformation. It starts out with a quote from Madeleine Albright at the 1997 Harvard University commencement. She said, today, I say that no nation in the world need be left out of the global system we are constructing. So there is a global system that is actively being constructed. The public in America and the Western nations have been under a mounting barrage of arguments stating that separate nations must enter a federation of world states, a new world order. If such a global system appears in our era, it will be the first time in history that the Earth will have a world government. There have been countless tries down through history, from Alexander the Great and Caesar Augustus to Charlemagne and Napoleon, but no one has ever been able to pull off the planetary bargain. The stakes are huge. To close the deal, the arguments must be compelling enough to convince nations and other citizens to surrender their sovereignty and freedom for the higher good of the planet. They warn of dire consequences if this does not take place. Descriptions of the good life are then added, ranging from heaven on earth, the end of poverty, war, and disease, to the inauguration of the anticipated new age of spiritual brotherhood, peace, and enlightenment. We are told the global state is worth the sacrifice. But at stake for Americans, among others, is our history and legacy as we have known it. The anticipated change could be far greater than when history leapt from the medieval period to the Renaissance. That's why it's called a new age. It's really an amazing thing that we're witnessing. Another quote, former Secretary of Defense Caspar Weinberger, in the February 15, 1993 issue of Forbes magazine, wrote that a new world order means the U.S. and other nations agree to be governed by a rule of law. Applying this on a world scale means that we could gain what we had hoped the UN would achieve, but has not, global law, breaches of which would be punished swiftly and with certainty. There are many, many people pushing for this kind of global community. I mentioned at the first that one of the things we're witnessing is the shift from a Christian to a global paradigm. In 1992 in Rio de Janeiro, there was a conference, and it was to put together an agenda for the 21st century. And what came out of that was Agenda 21. And this will explain a few things. It says, this global contract binds governments around the world to the UN plan for changing the ways we live, eat, learn, and communicate, all under the noble banner of saving the Earth. Its regulations would severely limit water, electricity, and transportation, even deny human access to our most treasured wilderness areas. It's interesting that during the Clinton administration, they went to all the, there were the roadless initiatives, you probably remember that, to where, you know, we set aside large tracts of wilderness areas and put different restrictions on them. And I know, you know, we like to go out in the boonies, and the big thing now is closing roads and, you know, is taking roads out and redoing them back to their natural state. But this is part of where that came from, following this agenda. If implemented, it would manage and monitor all lands and people. This agenda for the 21st century was signed by 179 nations at the UN Conference on Environment and Development in Rio de Janeiro in 1992. Among other things, it called for a global biodiversity assessment of the state of the planet, prepared by the UN Environmental Program. This GBA armed UN leaders with the information and science they needed to validate their global management system. Its predictions were designed to excuse radical population reduction, oppressive lifestyle regulations, and a coercive return to Earth-centered religions as a basis for environmental values and self-sustaining human settlements. A lot of these reports that come out are huge, as this shows. It says the GBA concluded on page 763 that the root causes of the loss of biodiversity are embedded in the way societies use resources. The main culprit? Judeo-Christian values. Chapter 12, and in a couple subheadings here, it states that this worldview is characteristic of large-scale societies, heavily dependent on resources brought from considerable distances. It is a worldview that is characterized by the denial of sacred attributes in nature, a characteristic that became firmly established about 2,000 years ago with the Judeo-Christian Islamic religious traditions. So that was their the main culprit, Judeo-Christian religious tradition. And it goes on, Eastern cultures with religious traditions such as Buddhism, Jainism, and Hinduism did not depart as drastically from the perspective of humans as members of a community of beings, including other living and non-living elements. So what they want to do is go to more of an earth-centered religion. And what you see out there developing in the New Age movement is, you know, New Age isn't New Age at all. You know, there's a lot of Hinduism in the New Age movement, a lot of earth-centered religion. And that's where some of that comes from. Now, the church is going to have a tremendous pressure to conform put on it. This is an article called Conforming the Church to the New Millennium. It starts with a quote from Bill Clinton in the 2000 State of the Union message. We restored the vital center, replacing outdated ideologies with a new vision anchored in basic enduring values, opportunity for all, responsibility from all, and a community of all Americans. We must shape a 21st century American revolution of opportunity, responsibility, a community, a new nation. Of course, they've redefined a few terms in here, too. There's a quote from our Episcopal Bishop John Shelby Sprong out of a book, Why Christianity Must Change or Die. This change will probably be radical, if not total. Those whose lives are dedicated to serving the church of the past will resist these suggestions with a vehemence that always emerges from threatened hierarchies and dying institutions. But the seeds of resurrection are present in the exiles, and in time those seeds will sprout and bloom. When they do, we will once again be able to see continuity between the church of the past and the purged and opened church of the future. And in the presidential campaign of the year 2000, we saw candidates Gore and candidate Bush talk about partnership. Remember that? Talked about government-church partnership. Year 2000 has arrived, ushering in the United Nations International Year of the Culture of Peace. It brings new pressures to establish the global management system President Clinton calls the Third Way. One that allows governments to yield responsibility, but not control, to their private and civil partners who will be required to implement the vision. The church-state partnerships touted by candidates Bush and Gore fit the picture. These political alliances are already being established from coast to coast, not by law, but by an army of willing and often well-meaning religious leaders, those who share the UN vision of the 21st century community usually lead the parade. They seek a global village of peace and social equity, unified not by faith in the biblical God, but by faith in human nature and the pluralistic God spirit operating in and through each person. Christian evangelism doesn't fit this utopian vision. It offends people of other faiths. It threatens the religious leaders who have built their platform on humanitarian ideals rather than the Bible. And it clashes with the international standards for tolerance and mental health. See, there are international standards that have been pushed forward. And what happens is, you know, these overriding standards are published and pushed. Other people pick up on them. And it comes down to where, you know, it feeds itself into the local level and down to local governments, and the agenda is in place to go clear down to the community level with guidelines and the whole nine yards. So it clashes with the international standards for tolerance and mental health. Mental health is another another buzzword you'll hear a lot. Well, there's a lot of talk about mental health. Of course, they've redefined mental health as well. This spiritual shift didn't start in the 90s. Liberal ecclesiastical leaders realized more than 50 years ago that biblical absolutes, separateness, and evangelism would block their agenda. To clear the way, they built the foundations of today's worldwide movement that would equate biblical truth and evangelism with hate and intolerance, would redefine Christianity, hold Christians accountable to global standards for mental health, and to conform churches to the demands of UNESCO's Declaration on Religion in a Culture of Peace. So there's tremendous pressure in the religious community to conform to certain standards. It was interesting, I was talking to Leanne Luker a couple weeks ago, and we were talking about ecumenical stuff or whatever, and she said, you know, it's interesting that our two elders in Italy, one is Carmelo Anastasi, and I forget the other guy down in Sicily, but they both received a letter from the Catholic Church asking them if they would participate in the ecumenical council, just asking them if they would. Of course, if they say no, then you're on the short list. So talking about character training and mental health, President Clinton summarized it well in his 1997 State of the Union speech. Character education must be taught in our schools. We must teach our children to be good citizens. Sounds like a good idea, right? Hey. But what kind of citizens are they talking about? What kind of character are they talking about? A lot is said about respect and responsibility. Take the word respect. Used in a global context, like tolerance, means appreciation for people and lifestyles that fit the globalist plan. Does your child's teacher promote respect? You know, respect for paganism. You know, how about organizing a nice, you know, earth-centered ritual in the classroom? You know, all out of respect. Learning to respect people. Respect other cultures, respect, you know, this, that, and the other thing. I'd like to read a quote from a famous individual. You'll recognize his name immediately once I say who he is. It's a quote from his book. The state must not adjust its entire educational work primarily to the inculcation of mere knowledge. The training of mental abilities is only secondary. First place must be taken by the development of character, especially promotion of willpower and determination, combined with the training of joy in responsibility. A man with little scientific education, but a good, firm character is more valuable for the national community than a clever weakling. In this hard struggle of destiny, the man who knows least seldom succumbs. That's from the book Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler. You know, he understood what was necessary. You know, talking about the far-reaching tentacles and so forth, you know, this is an ideology that is being pushed on every level. To see how far it goes, there's a Colorado law that became effective July 1st, 1997. There's a little quote about it. A Colorado law gives us a glimpse of what we might expect once the system is fully in place. It suggests that Christian child raising could be considered, and this is quotes from the bill, emotional abuse or a substantial risk. Puts a child in a substantial risk category. and gives the social services the authority to prosecute Christian parents for child abuse. To protect, now, you know, this didn't happen, you know, in a corner. To protect Christian families, conservatives pressed the legislature to add an exemption to the proposed bill. And the exemption was going to declare, emotional abuse shall not be construed to include religious instruction. So they wanted to put that phrase in there to say that, hey, you can't construe religious instruction as abuse. But this exemption was deleted before this House bill was passed, titled Children's Services, and became effective July 1st, 1997. Now, every Colorado family that trains its children to follow God risks breaking the law and facing the fury of the Child Protection Service. Isn't that amazing? You know, our children are the ones who are going to face, you know, the brunt of this. You know, they have a way to deal with people that are, you know, like me, 50 and above. They just wait and we die. We just go away. That's why they say that part of the problem is, you know, that children hold the ideals of their parents. You know, if they can break that, then they've, you know, their long-term goals can be accomplished. So children tend to be targets. So a couple of quotes here. I'm getting down to the end of the quotes. I know you're probably tired of them by now. Professor John Goodlad, serving on the governing board of UNESCO's Institute for Education before he joined Bill Clinton on the 1987 Study Commission on Global Education. In his preface to a book called Schooling for a Global Age, he wrote, that's what he wrote, enlightened social engineering is required to face situations that demand global action now. Education is a long-term solution. The majority of our youth still hold the same values as their parents. So this is a problem. And if we don't re-socialize, our system will decay. So you have, you know, people like this in positions, you know, steering things. This is a quote from Professor Raymond Houghton. He wrote in an NEA publication back in the 1970s. So this is a National Education Association, I believe. The critical point in behavior control, in effect, is sneaking up on mankind without his self-conscious realization that a crisis is at hand. Man will not even know what is about to happen. Interesting. There's a new term out called edutainment. Combination of education and entertainment. There's a quote from Ann Wood, who's the creator of the Teletubbies. I believe television and video are the most underestimated force for good in the educating of our children in the technological age in which we live. It is important to develop children's thinking skills. I read an article on the Teletubbies, and I thought, you know, I had seen him just flipping, you know, I'd seen him, but I didn't know anything about him. Then I read this article and I thought, this can't be, you know. So I watched the show. Here I am watching the Teletubbies, you know, and my son walks by, sees me, you know, and just yells out, Mom, you got to see this. Dad's watching the Teletubbies, you know. But it's interesting, that show is not an accident. And I'll only say one thing about them. One part of what they do is how can you possibly criticize this cute little kids show? you know, anybody that would criticize the show has got to be some kind of a, you know, just a wacko. So here I am, you know. But anyway, I'll only say one thing. This show is for toddlers. It's for toddlers. And, you know, you deal with toddlers on a toddler level, right? Well, the only thing I'll say is, you know, watch the show sometime. How much do these Teletubbies learn from their parents? Nothing. You know, there aren't any parents. It's all peers. But anyway, our kids are being targeted. I read another article, and I wrote this little blurb down. I didn't even write down where I got it, but I believe that this is the overriding goal of people who are pushing this agenda. So children are learning a new perception of reality. Their minds must be so steeped in this new paradigm that their intuitive response to the old ways would be instant rejection. You know, intuition is a quick perception of truth without conscious attention or reasoning. So it's just your instant response. And the goal is to train our children to where the instant response to biblical Christianity would be rejection. You know, there are no absolutes. You know, it's intolerant, hateful. You know, the instant response is rejection. Well, this system keeps coming. You know, when I first gave that sermonette over a year ago, it was pretty much there to see. And it's more blatant now than it was then. And it just keeps coming. Because one of their mottos is, you know, inch by inch, just inch. Little by little, incremental. Little by little, here it comes. So what does this mean to us? What should we do? I mean, there are people fighting this. There are congressmen fighting this. But they're not getting anywhere. Because it's just like a groundswell. So what do we do? What can we do? I have 3 points. Number one, recognize that we are fighting for spiritual survival. You know, if you don't even know you're in a war, just hope. You know, we have to recognize that we are fighting for our spiritual survival. Ephesians 6 and verse 13 talks about the armor that we have. Ephesians 6:13. Has taken to you the whole armor of God, that you may be able to withstand in the evil day, and having done all, to stand. So here it says, this is why you take this armor, so that you can withstand the evil day. And no matter how this turns out, you know, I'm not here to say that, you know, this, you know, the UN is, you know, the beast or whatever. You know, I don't know. You know, is this going to all blow up and something else will happen? I don't know. Is somebody going to take control of it and, you know, steer it some way we don't know? I don't know. You know, but what I do know is this is happening. And as it is happening, you know, we need to recognize that we are in a fight for our spiritual survival, and we need to put on this armor. So stand, therefore, having your loins girt about with truth. See, truth has been redefined as well. Truth is not absolute anymore in some circles. It's your truth, my truth. They'll tell you, don't follow my truth. Follow your own truth. Well, you know, to us, that's, yeah, you know. But hey, that's, I hear and read that. And having on the breastplate of righteousness, and your feet shod with the preparation of the gospel of peace. Above all, taking the shield of faith, wherewith you may be able to quench the fiery darts of the wicked. See, we're entering a time when we will need tremendous faith to survive. Tremendous faith. And take the helmet of salvation and the sword of the Spirit, which is the Word of God. And this is praying always. We need to pray and put on this armor. And a sub-point under this first point, we need to know our enemy. And that's kind of what we've done today, is, you know, take a look at what's going on. You know, take a look at the forces that are arrayed against us. And then see, sub-point under this, is we need to network with others of like mind. Now we need each other. Network with others of like mind. Support each other in this battle that we're in, which of course we've always done. Point number two. You know, to be forewarned is forearmed, and you know, we need to think about what we would do in a given situation. And this is a broad point. But physically speaking, we need to be willing to lose it all. You know, the Bible is clear on this. Let's turn to Luke 14 and verse 26. Luke 14, 26. Jesus speaking, he says, if a man comes to me and hate not his father and mother and wife and children and brethren and sisters, yea, and his own life also, he cannot be my disciple. And of course, we know that the word hate here in the Old King James is love less, because God is first in our lives and everything else is secondary. So that's exactly what Christ is saying. If any man comes to me and loves anything else more, then you're not worthy of me. Verse 27, and whosoever does not bear his cross and come after me cannot be my disciple. So whatever it takes, we need to do it. For which of you, intending to build a tower, sits not down first and counts the cost, whether he has sufficient to finish it? Lest haply, after he's laid the foundation and is not able to finish it, all that behold it begin to mock him, saying, this man began to build and was not able to finish. Or what king, going to make war against another king, sits not down first and consults whether he is able with 10,000 to meet him that comes against him with 20,000? Or else while the other is yet a way off, he sends an ambassage and desires conditions of peace. So likewise, whosoever he be of you that forsakes not all that he has cannot be my disciple. Salt is good, but if the salt has lost its savor, wherewith shall it be seasoned? It is neither fit to be for the land, nor yet for the dunghill, but men cast it out. He that has ears to hear, let him hear. So what Jesus is telling us is that we need to be willing to forsake everything to follow him. When we were baptized, you know, this was explained, and we assented to this, that we would follow Jesus Christ no matter what. You know, Satan's biggest weapon is the fear of death. That's his biggest weapon. You read that back in Job when Satan went to God. And God said, well, you know, if you seen my servant Job, you know, how he serves me faithfully. And through the course of the conversation, it finally got to the point where Satan said, well, yeah, but a man will do anything to save his life. And that's Satan's big gun, the fear of death. And here, you know, it says, yea, and his own life also, verse 26. You know, we have to be willing to lose everything. And I know in my life, I have seen God work. And usually, if you make up your mind beforehand, then God, you know, generally will not test you on that. If you make your mind up, and you can't fool God, of course, but if your mind is made up and God can see that, a lot of times you won't be tested on that. Let's turn to Luke 16, just a couple pages over, verse 13. It says, no servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will hold to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. You can't serve God and money. You know, that's a principle in the Bible, you know, that we all know. You know, if money is your God, you know, how can you serve the true God? And if you serve the true God, you obviously can't serve the God money. And we all need money, etc. But it's interesting, in the end time, this will come into play in a way that is inescapable. And that's in Revelation 13, verse 16 and 17. Was talking about the mark of the beast. And he caused all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and bond, to receive a mark in their right hands or in their foreheads. And that no man might buy or sell, save he had the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So there's going to come a time in this global system when you will either be a part of that system or you won't. And if you aren't, it says, you know, no one will be able to buy and sell. You know, I don't know what that would be. There's tons of conjecture. The technology exists to make it happen, put it that way. You know, what it will be, I don't know. But the banking industry especially is pushing for a personal identifier that is specific to each individual person. You know, whether that's going to be, you know, retina scan, fingerprint, you know, they like the retina scan. But technology is getting so small. You know, they're talking about, you know, chips that are, you know, microscopic. They've actually tested a single cell animal that acts as a transistor. There's some really interesting stuff. But the bottom line is, I was reading an article yesterday even, they feel that they can get a digital, it would be a little digital tracking device that would even be cheap enough to replace the barcode so that they could track product all the way. You know, they could track individual product. You know, they can kind of do that now, but not the way they could do it then. But anyway, technology is getting to the point that, you know, that this could easily happen. But when that, you know, think of the implications of that happening to where you literally cannot make a transaction without this mark, whatever it would be, doesn't matter. So you need to make a choice about what you're going to do, because you know you can't you can't pay your property tax, you can't, you know, access your 401k, you know, you can't get Social Security, you can't, you know, you're out of the loop. I mean, it's almost that bad now. You know, I went to get my driver's license renewed, and, you know, big sign, you know, you got to give your Social Security number to get a driver's license now. You know, I mean, everything's starting to get tied together. Recently, the head of the Canadian privacy, whatever they call it, some kind of a privacy agency, quit. He just said, I can't do this anymore. So this is, it's just too bad. He said they have 1,200 bits of information on every living Canadian. You know, I don't know if there's more on dead ones or less, but, you know, 1,200 bits of information. They're also making the census AI all the time thing. They're going to do the census all the time. So if you didn't like that long form, you may get another one. So anyway, we have decisions to make, and it's a serious thing, and we need to make those decisions now and commit ourselves like we never have before. The third thing that we need to do, seeing this coming, we need to do the work now. There's no better time to do the work than right now. John 9 and verse 4. Jesus is talking. He says, I must do the works of him that sent me while it is day. The night comes when no man can work. I think that applies to us as well. You know, we have to do the work while it is day, because the night is coming. You know, who knows when, how long it'll be before preaching the true gospel is a hate crime. You know, it could be construed as that in this new global paradigm. You know, warm and fuzzy Christianity, I'm sure, will be fine. But to proclaim the true gospel and to preach the gospel straight out of the Bible, you already can't do that in Canada. So the time to do the work is now. Well, hopefully I haven't scared anyone too badly. But hopefully this helps put things in a framework. You know, I always wondered, what in the world is going on? Why is President Clinton doing this or doing that? Because I kept thinking, you know, he's President of the United States. He's responsible to the citizens of the United States. I'm a citizen of the United States. I can't see that what he's doing does any good at all for me. So why is he doing it? And then when I realized that he was simply following a UN agenda, then it all made sense. Well, of course he did that, because that's following the agenda. So hopefully it helps put things into perspective. So inch by inch, it's coming. And we need to recognize that we're fighting for our spiritual survival. That we need to be willing to sacrifice everything to follow Jesus Christ. And we need to do the work now. There is an urgency, not only because it's the thing to do, but because we need to do it now while we can. We have an obligation to God our Father to stay spiritually fit and ready. And we have an obligation to do His work and proclaim the true solution to mankind's problems, which is the coming kingdom of God.